Ah, that's a helpful chime to know what's going on. Well, thank you all for joining. I'm sure more people are popping on as I speak, but we don't have the tone to notify that. So thank you as we get started. This is the second year we've done this conversation, so we hope that everyone finds it helpful and hopefully can identify some of the pressing trends that are going to be of importance throughout 2016 and even moving forward beyond that. My name's Jackson. I work on behalf of Quarles and Brady. Many of you probably connected with a colleague of mine within the past month or so, and we're so happy you could join us. I'm going to kick it over to Jim Kaplan and Stephen Hunter, who will introduce themselves, tell you briefly about their practice area, and then we'll dive on in into the topics at hand. So, Jim, do you want to take it away?
Sure. It's a delight to do this. Always happy to talk about these issues, and we certainly have a lot to talk about today. My practice focuses on pretty much financial institutions. Everything that happens in a bank, we get involved with regulatory matters, mergers and acquisitions, litigation, a full financial practice, and it stems from not only my work at the law firm, but also for 17 years I was a general counsel or first deputy general counsel of three significant financial institutions. I come at it with both a banker's view and, of course, a bank lawyer's view. So that's my perspective. Stephen?
Stephen Hunter. I am a litigation partner here at Quarles & Brady, and I do a breadth of litigation for different clients as well as banking clients. And I have a focus on cybersecurity, security issues, particularly looking at banking security issues.
So, Jackson, should we just dive right in here to our overstuffed agenda?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I wanted to say up front, too, while we have a formal spot for Q&A at the end of all the discussion, we encourage anyone on the line that has a question as it comes up, please go ahead and interject it while we're talking about the topic matter, too. You don't have to save your questions for the end of the call because we want to address it while it's top of mind, and we don't want you to lose those. But with that said, I'll let Jim start off with the Basel III discussion.
Thank you, Jackson. What do we talk about when we talk about Basel III? I think we don't just mean the enhanced capital standards that Basel III included and have now imposed on every bank, virtually every bank in the United States, through implementation by the Fed and the other federal regulators. What we mean, I think, is the entire regime of both enhanced capital and, on the one hand, and de-risking of the banking business, on the other hand, that were accomplished by a mix of enhanced capital standards and then a variety of provisions, most of them contained in the Dodd-Frank legislation that passed in 2010 and has now been with us for 5-6 years. So those have been pretty fully implemented by now. And what we have seen is that some of the things, all taken together, they have pretty dramatically changed the banking business. We found, for example, a Brookings Institution study found that of the six largest banks in the United States, their capital had increased from about 7 or 8% before the crisis to now, on average, 13-14%. That's a huge change. In addition, Dodd-Frank de-risked, if you will, the business so that not only would you have more capital to deal with risk, but in addition, the risks were smaller. So, for example, the Volcker rule, the limitation on banks getting involved in private equity or hedge funds, which is what the Volcker rule is, and in proprietary trading, which is what the Volcker rule is. The derivative push-out, where you couldn't do principal derivative activities inside of a federally regulated institution. That was done. Enhanced liquidity requirements, because it was felt during the crisis a lot of institutions, particularly big ones, didn't have adequate liquidity and didn't have immediate funds that they could use to deal with the crisis. So that was imposed. The ability to repay rule on the mortgage side. Again, you can't make a mortgage, simple concept, I guess, complex in practice, but you can't any longer make a mortgage. You don't feel, and you can prove, essentially, that the borrower has the ability to repay, because it was felt that was a problem that led to the crisis. A lot of mortgages were subprime, and others were made that endangered the system in broad terms. So all of this is pretty fully implemented by now, and it's changed the business. It has de-risked it. It has made it more capital intensive. It has lowered, probably long term, we'll see more of it as we go along. Profitability has been pretty good, and it's held up, but mainly because that's compared to the years during and immediately before the crisis, when profitability took a nosedive. I think longer term, what most bankers and most senior executives at banks and boards feel is that longer term, these changes to the business have made it probably less profitable. Certainly less return on equity, because the equity is so much higher. And by de-risking it, it has discouraged or outright prohibited getting into businesses where the return on equity would be greater and the risk would be greater, because the risk is greater. So things like the Volcker activities, the subprime and less than prime lending, derivatives, proprietary derivatives trading, all of those moved out, those are riskier. Those can be more profitable in good times, and so those are no longer as much a part of the bank financial statement as they were previously. So all of that has an impact. It is longer term, less return for shareholders, lower returns on equity, probably lower dividend yields. As banks use earnings, instead of paying dividends out, they use earnings to buttress their capital, which again is an ongoing thing. It's not a one-shot deal. It continues at these elevated. Basel III and Dodd-Frank's enhanced capital standards also discouraged certain activities through risk weighting. They assigned a larger risk and thus more capital to things like residential mortgage lending and things of that sort. So all in all, they have had this effect. It has interplayed, I think, with a slower growth economy, and in fact been a factor in the slower growth economy since 2009. I think it's a lot of that had to do with the fact that riskier lending is now discouraged. It's now punished both in the examination process and by regulation through the capital rules or the capital set aside, the greater capital set asides for riskier loans, and so the kind of speculative lending, particularly real estate lending that we saw, both residential and commercial, that we saw in the run-up to the crisis and the recession in 2008-2009, that just doesn't happen as much anymore. And so, what it means is a slower growth economy, and that's its impact. One thing I would want to emphasize is that the capital has been relatively fortunate. The capital has been relatively easy to raise. As I say, bank profits went up. In part, bank profits went up because banks no longer had to set aside as much into their loan loss reserves as they did previously during the crisis and during the worst of the recession. So indeed, that helped. There was a certain flight to quality, so the bigger banks were able to make more, and many smaller banks had real difficulty and continue to have real difficulty being profitable in the new environment, if nothing else, because of the massively increased compliance costs. But we've been fortunate in that regard. The environment has been good, and so we have suffered relatively little from this catch up, these enhanced capital and other prudential standards. But the thing that has been most noticeable is, in my view, they have had an actual effect on the real economy. Cruise rate for the economy now is, for the U.S. economy now, is instead of being a 3 to 4% GDP growth, we now routinely see high ones to middle twos, and almost never anything else. The U.S. economy has not grown, the GDP has not grown by more than 3% since 2005, and that is a sea change and extraordinary, and a lot of it owes to what we see here. I think with that, I'm gonna stop talking about enhanced capital, enhanced regulatory standards. We'll return to this at the very end, and we'll talk a little bit about the election year and how that impacts things. But now I'm going to turn it over to Stephen Hunter to talk about data privacy.
Hello, everyone. So I think in the next year, there are a few kind of trends we can expect in the data privacy area, especially with respect to banking. First of all, I think we can expect an uptick in at least coverage about attacks on regional or small banks. These are the most vulnerable in the banking system. Their breaches often don't get a lot of press, but they're the banks that have the least amount of resources really to dedicate toward enhancing their security. Lots of the large banks have premier security systems, and even they are compromised sometimes. But there has not been a lot of focus of late on the regional banks and the smaller banks and how they're vulnerable to attack. So I think we can expect kind of an uptick in that in 2016. Also, with respect to cloud computing, I think we can expect a shift in cloud computing. Currently, about less than 12% of financial institutions in the United States, regardless of size, are 100%, have their IT function 100% outsourced. And I think that's going to shift in 2016 and 2017. There's a push to, well, banks have to navigate whether or not they're going to lose control of some of the security responsible for, or whether they're going to outsource that. Typically, banks have preferred, at least the larger banks, have preferred to keep this internally since they are the ones who have all of the liability for it. But there are a growing number of cloud computing providers who actually provide better security than some of the banks are able to offer for themselves. Certainly, the regional and small banks might benefit from a cloud computing solution rather than trying to do this internally, because they would benefit from the premier security services of some of the cloud. But obviously, there's a challenge with outsourcing your IT function and maintaining all of the liability in the event that something goes wrong. There's also issues with business continuity. If something happens in the cloud and customers are not able to access their funds or et cetera, then the bank has a serious customer communication issue. I expect there will also be more mobile computing type security issues. Mobile security and Internet of Things, I would say, are pretty much very similar in their vulnerability. The banks are realizing that people want to access, and more people are accessing their banking and doing their banking online using mobile technology, using payments, mobile payments, and the like. And these are particularly susceptible to hack, right? I mean, whether it be by someone being close by and actually hacking into the Wi-Fi, or whether it be by someone actually getting access to the mobile device, or someone replicating the mobile device and accessing the system. Banks are really dealing with or struggling with how to deal with that kind of mobile computing increased security risk. I mean, currently, encryption is what the banks are using, and obviously the dual sign-in, et cetera. But like I said, those issues will be more prevalent, I think, in 2016 than they have been previously. Also, the switch, another thing that will be important in the news with respect to security is the banks switching from the magnetic stripe to the card. Lots of the banks currently have both. Most of the major banks have switched to a system where you have both. The issue is the retailers upgrading their product so that you can use a chip as well as a stripe, the magnetic stripe here in the United States. As we know and have figured out from years previous, the chip is much more secure than the magnetic stripe. And so I think that will be another thing that is prevalent this year as banks start to switch from one technology to another, and as retailers start to switch from one technology to another.
You know, Stephen, that stripe.
Yes.
I mean, in the business, what we've seen often is that really very primitive type of fraud and breaches are able to be accomplished with the stripe.
Oh, yeah.
For example, you know, we had one client, a small bank in Wisconsin, you know, folks in the parking lot were able to, in the parking lot of a major retailer, mm-hmm. were able to capture
right.
the PINs and credit card numbers and so and, mm-hmm. and debit card numbers simply by sitting
right.
in a van in the parking lot and pulling it off the terminal.
Well, Jim, it's even easier than that. When back in the 90s, there was someone who gave a presentation about, you know, how this could be done easily with a VCR tape. All you had to do was put one side of a VCR tape on the magnetic strip and flip it, and you could take all the information from that strip and iron it on to a regular library card, and you would have compromised that particular credit card.
So
the magnetic strip is very vulnerable
right.
to false reproduction. And
the chip should help, and the other stuff you're describing should help.
Well, and the Internet of Things brings me to kind of my final example of something that is going to be a little more prevalent in 2016. The Internet of Things, as you all probably know, most of our household appliances and other things will be connected to the Internet. We'll know when our washer dryer turns off, and we'll know when the lights turn on and how much energy we have, et cetera. But with those things, with those tools being connected to the Internet, they're also, from a security standpoint, we look at it as points of possible entry or points for your information to be compromised. Is it possible to hack someone's refrigerator, right? Is it possible to get access to someone's personal information by going in through one of these kind of Internet of Things points of access? And security, the experts in cybersecurity, IT people who are much smarter than I, do see that this is a risk for banks, that Internet of Things and the security related to that could be a problem with mobile technology, and could be a problem for banks trying to secure their system through mobile technology. The precise, I guess, mechanism of the breach has not necessarily been figured out, but security, the top folks in security, say from Microsoft and other places, are saying that the Internet of Things is something that we should be concerned with respect to security vulnerability over the net. And that's all that I have for the security section. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Jim.
And then I think next on our agenda, we wanted to touch on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. Again, the CFPB was a major part of the Dodd-Frank legislation. It was, in a sense, path-breaking. I mean, the perceived need was to protect consumers against the sort of abuses that had really almost swallowed the mortgage business, particularly, and the credit card business in the years before the crisis. So a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created with extraordinary powers of examination and enforcement. It cuts across regulated industries. That is, it brings in both the banking and the shadow banking systems. So that was unusual and in a sense unprecedented for federal regulatory legislation. So Stephen, you want to
yes.
you want to talk about how do you think it's going?
Yes. Well,
about 5 years in.
Yes. Well, this is what's very interesting is the area of disparate impact and how. So in June of 2015, the Obama administration won a major decision in the Supreme Court, Texas Department of Housing versus Inclusive Communities Project, where the Supreme Court ruled that the CFPB, the government, could use the disparate impact that banks' lending policies have on communities of color or protected classes. This was a major, major debate, and the banks put up one hell of a fight to not have disparate impact be used. There are arguments really on both sides currently about that. This is, again, a focus on the regional banks. Some critics of the decision have believed that regional banks, specifically banks that focus on minority communities, might be adversely affected by a disparate impact analysis, meaning if most of your customers are African American or Latino or Asian or part of the or one of the protected classes, of course you're going to have more people in a protected class that are denied loans simply because that's your community that you're lending to. And it might be the same percentage as other banks would have in a different community. But on the other hand, proponents, obviously, of the disparate impact analysis think that it's great in order to make lending more fair among races. There are several cases where African Americans, Latino Americans, they found have been paying a significant amount more in their loans than non-Latino or protected class individuals. So this will be, and the CFPB is in charge and of enforcing this and have been enforcing it since, I'm assuming, since the June of 2014. Of 2015 when this ruling came down. This is something that will require the banks to do a little bit more analysis. It's not just saying it's not just having a policy saying you may not discriminate against people because of their race. This requires the banks to do a little bit more analysis to determine whether their banking policies, whether their credit policies actually have a disparate impact on a particular group of people. This is something that banks are not typically in the business of doing. They are typically in the business of setting credit policies and making credit decisions for each particular potential borrower that comes in the door. And this requires them to look at their credit policy globally. It will require additional resources on the part of the bank to be able to assess kind of the disparate impact, and also trying to create a policy that doesn't have the disparate impact but also satisfies the credit obligations is a tough balance and going to be a tough balance for the banks going forward.
I think on the CFPB generally, before we leave it in consumer protection, I think we need to make an assessment of what it has accomplished, and so far, it's early in the years since it was included as a key part, frankly, of Dodd-Frank. I think, again, as we saw with the enhanced prudential standards and the enhanced capital guidelines, the results are mixed. The CFPB has been quite aggressive and shows signs of even becoming more aggressive with investigations and enforcement actions on the shadow banking sector. This would be regarded, I think, by most of the financial industry as probably positive. That is, not only those who make the loans, but also the third-party debt collectors, the distressed asset buyers, the payday lenders. I mean, all of those areas are certainly fraught with risks for financial institutions that engage in them, and often act as sort of bottom feeders, if you will, with respect to the mainstream financial institutions, even competitors in some of those areas. So the idea that area is being policed and regulated, which it really had not been to any extent before, is probably viewed by most financial institutions in the industry as positive. The problem, though, comes in the robust enforcement of some of the Dodd-Frank rules, like the ability to repay rule, the new integrated mortgage disclosures, and other things on regulated financial institutions that really don't function in the subprime or less than prime markets to any great extent. And in fact, what too robust enforcement of that agenda can lead to is a chilling of credit to American consumers and small businesses that ought to get it. Again, it has an impact on economic growth, and there are those, me among them, who say that the enhanced enforcement, the enhanced costs of this sort of regulation, not only by the CFPB, but by increasingly state attorney generals, and even the traditional bank regulators enforcing CFPB rules, which they must under the law now since Dodd-Frank, all of that has an effect on the ability of ordinary consumers to get credit and to be able to refinance and improve their economic circumstances in a lower interest rate environment that we've had now for the past 7 years, since the crisis. So there's a balancing that needs to be done, and the balancing continues to go on with respect to the CFPB. One more word before we leave the consumer side is we want to touch on Fannie and Freddie and the mortgage market. Everybody from the Obama administration to virtually, I think, all of the Republicans in Congress, all of them want to do away with Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie are still going strong. They took enormous losses in the immediate aftermath and for years after the crisis. They are now quite profitable again and contributing. They are essentially paying down the debt that their losses caused in the aftermath of the crisis. So that's what's happening on Fannie and Freddie. There is no immediate plans to discontinue them, and I think it is unlikely that in the long term something like Fannie and Freddie won't continue to exist in America. The reason is because is rooted in just in sort of basic economics as we've come to see them since the crisis, which is that American consumers, first of all, they want to own their own homes. And secondly, they prefer long-term fixed-rate mortgage financing. Those products have been rendered relatively undesirable to banks and even third-party investors who buy them. They are looked on as too lengthy. 30-year loans are looked on as too long and too risky in credit terms, and also substantial interest rate risk attends them, because the promise to receive a fixed rate of interest when rates can go up an unlimited amount, especially over that long a period of time, is looked on as highly undesirable and, in fact, too risky for ordinary bank balance sheets. So the result is that what we developed in the decades before the crisis was the fact that a government-sponsored enterprise, either Fannie, Freddie, or the FHA, would in fact take those loans. They'd buy them, they'd guarantee them, they'd sell them off to third-party investors, but with a government guarantee, however, or with a Fannie or Freddie guarantee, which was perceived as being the equivalent of a federal guarantee. So the result is that our mortgage market really can't function the way most Americans would want it to without an entity like Fannie or Freddie acting as the ultimate guarantor of mortgages that, frankly, investors don't want to buy, and banks really don't want to make and hold. They want to make them for the upfront fees they can get. That's a profitable business, but portfolioing those loans, keeping them forever, is not a profitable activity, and in fact entails a great deal of risk. It may be that American consumers' tastes will change. People say a younger generation are more, first of all, they're less tied into home ownership, and second, they're more amenable to variable rate mortgages and others that would be much more amenable to banks and to investors. But we'll see about that. In the years since the crisis, the new mortgages that have been written are overwhelmingly, as much as ever, I believe by some estimates, three quarters, are still 30-year fixed rate loans, which are the long term or the bane of the banking business, and what ultimately led to Fannie and Freddie, and ultimately led to Fannie and Freddie's difficulties. So the upshot is, that probably won't change, much as everyone would like it. It appears that Fannie, Freddie, the FHA, or something like them, is going to continue into the indefinite future. Our next topic is M&A. I think the question here is the sector finally poised to see increased activity? We saw a little bit of increased activity in 2015. 2015 was a big M&A year for a lot of industries, particularly in healthcare and information technology, and also in energy. But we did not see an awful lot of breakout deals in M&A, just in the financial industry, M&A, just a few. In our own practice, we're starting to see some banks, some larger banks, make bids and come to terms with smaller banks. The sector is highly unconsolidated in America. There are still thousands of banking institutions, in contrast to other advanced economies where usually just fewer than 10 banks dominate the scene. And so one would think that there is a lot of room for consolidation. That's particularly so given the high increased costs of compliance and regulatory and all the regulatory enhancement that we've described earlier in our conversation today. So you would think bank boards, especially smaller bank boards, would be willing to sell at this point, and the industry would rapidly consolidate. That has not happened very much up till now. One of the reasons it hasn't is because with the economy growing relatively slowly, with earnings growing but in a controlled manner, the pricing for additional assets that larger banks, buyers, want to pay just isn't isn't satisfactory to the sellers. So what we've seen is not much activity. This has been complicated or added to by the fact that the bank regulators, although they appear to have a long-term view that, there ought to be consolidation in the industry, if for no other reason than fewer numbers of banks are easier to regulate, and in their view, safer and sounder, and also are bigger and have more capital, that the attitude of the regulators has been, let's, you know, fix your own house first before going and buying someone else's. And so they have been generally discouraging. And again, regulators in the financial industry have to, and the banking business, have to approve all mergers and acquisitions. So they have a major voice in it. There is evidence in some recent deals that they have relented, that the regulators have a more positive attitude. They finally let the M&T Hudson City Bancorp deal go through. There have been some other notable ones. But we will see. Most people are calling for a somewhat increased M&A activity in 2016, a gradual increase as we put the crisis and its aftermath further and further behind us. And finally, I think we're going to return. We're going to now give thoughts to proposals that have been made with respect to regulating the industry, or adding to or modifying Dodd-Frank and the Basel structure and the other regulatory structures that were put in place in the aftermath of the crisis. I think the leading proposals, and this is championed by people like Senator Sanders and Senator Warren, is to restore Glass-Steagall and restore the line between commercial banking and investment banking. This, although it has a constituency, both in the country and in the Congress, there are a lot of us, including me, who question this sort of approach. It's usually coupled with a proposal, as Senator Sanders has made, to break up banks that are too big. Too big is undefined, but that is just too big by some definition. The problem with this is that it's a proposal that, these tend to be proposals that were appropriate in the 1930s, but they're now superimposed on a reality that's in the 2010s, almost 100 years later. And they don't seem to fit the industry that we in fact have. To a certain extent, they're also addressing problems that really had very little role in the crisis. In fact, some of the while it's true that some mixed commercial and investment banks ran into trouble and had to be recapitalized, like Citigroup would be the one, probably the poster child for that in the crisis, probably at least as much danger, if not more, was created by the monoline investment bank, old line investment banks that were sort of, you know, they were Glass-Steagall creations, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, all of whom were engaging in risky market-based activities without bank-imposed capital requirements. So, in fact, all of them became, essentially all of them, or most of them became, the big ones, became regulated bank holding companies voluntarily, so that they would qualify for the Fed's aid to regulated financial institutions, and also as part of that they would have to voluntarily take on the new enhanced capital requirements. So again, it's the old distinction between commercial and investment banks, where you create a less regulated and less capitalized investment banking sector, seems like a further invitation to danger and enhanced risk as opposed to lessening risk. There are also other proposals to in effect enhance the criminalization of certain activities, of certain legal violations. For example, Senator Sanders, in a speech last week, recommended seemed to indicate that any money laundering and that the bankroll and any money laundering and know your customer should be further criminalized. He criticized an anti-money laundering case involving Wachovia, the former, it's now merged into Wells Fargo, but it existed before 2009, involving Wachovia, and he said there should have been criminal penalties there. Without commenting on that specific case, a further criminalization of the anti-money laundering rules or the other regulatory rules that govern banks, again, would have an undoubted chilling effect on economic activity. And the alternative to a lot of this criminalization and to breaking banks up and to reimposing 100-year-old deadlines, of course, 100-year-old solutions, of course, is more robust risk management. And banks in the period since the crisis have all of them, all of the major ones, have raised their game in these terms. They have created committees and focused resources and activity in these areas to meet the enhanced capital standards, enhanced regulatory and prudential standards, and as near as we can tell, the jury's still out, but this has had a salutary effect. The major breaches of significant law and prudential standards in these areas appear to be at least under control, going down, and more meaningfully addressed by banks. But again, the enhanced standards, the enhanced pressure on compliance remains, and as I said, the jury is out on whether enhanced regulatory robustness in the risk management area will be able long term to meet the challenges for an undoubtedly more complex and challenging banking business. So, Stephen, I think that concludes
our
remarks, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
One thing, and this is Jackson, jumping back on the line, one thing that I'd be interested in hearing just as a framework for everything else that you've discussed is, what do you think are going to be the top topics of concern in the 2016 debates as it relates to some of your banking clients?
It's a great question. I think some of the stuff we talked about just a moment ago, but I'll reiterate them, Jackson, because it's worth reiterating. I think the proposal to break up big banks will have some legs. That will pretty much, almost regardless of who we of who the major parties nominate, I think that will be a discussion. I think certainly from the left wing of the Democratic Party, the proposal to reinstall the Glass-Steagall divide between commercial and investment banking will not go away. Even if Senator Sanders is not the Democratic nominee, I think the enhanced role for the left wing of the party, symbolized by Senator Warren, who very much pushes for, believes in the reimposition of the Glass-Steagall Wall. I think that will undoubtedly continue on, and we haven't heard the end of that. And then I think the question of the enhanced consumer protections, mm-hmm. particularly in the mortgage,
yep.
in the data privacy, in the credit card, in all those areas, will continue to be an issue. And further, I think the equal credit opportunity and issues will not go away, and they will have legs. I think they serve a role. The kind of cases Stephen was talking about and the disparate impact under those statutes, under ECOA and the FHA, I think those are a companion to the kind of things we see in the criminal justice area and in the police treatment of minority issues that we see in so many big cities, in the Black Lives Matter movement. I think a companion in the economic realm is a thought that there maybe has been discrimination, or that large financial institutions discriminate. And so I think those issues will continue to be debated as a part of that.
I agree with everything Jim said in the way he put it. I thought it was great.
Guys, this is Matt Kelly from Radical Compliance and that blog that I run. I do have a question, probably more for Jim, I think. One thing I had noticed just before Christmas, the Fed had put out some guidance about its countercyclical buffer requirements and how it was looking to get a better sense of abnormal risk or systemic risk in the financial system. I guess my question is, do they, the regulators, or we on the phone, or anybody in the world, do we have a good sense of what an abnormal amount of systemic risk actually looks like right now? I mean, you know, I could say that might be depressed oil prices are going to gum up some of the assets you have on your books, or is it some sort of poor loan performance that's creeping into auto loans or student loans, like we saw with housing. Or it could be a slowdown in China. I mean, that was the very first thing I thought of when I saw that. I was like, wait a minute, who defined what abnormal levels of systemic risk is? I was just curious if you had a better read on that than me.
It's a great question. The answer is I probably don't have a better read than you. It's a great question, and it's one that the actually, the group under Dodd-Frank that's charged with this
yep.
mostly is the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is
yep.
The big regulators plus the Secretary of the Treasury, and that's the group, and they regulate the biggest institutions and those that are significant, systemically significant in the language of the statute, SIFIs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're charged with figuring this out. That is, they're charged with figuring out what constitutes it. And, you've raised a point, which is that this is going to have to flow from their brains. It's not something that is intuitive. If I were to say what would be abnormal risky activity, or words that you used, I would say the closest I can come to it is something like what we saw in the run-up to the financial crisis, which is to say increasing investment and lending in ways that were that implicated much greater than normal credit or interest rate risk in order to keep a certain level of earnings up as opposed to with a view toward longer-term earnings and stability. I think at least in the banking business, I think that would be abnormal risk. The kind of frothiness that you saw, particularly in the real estate markets, in the run-up to crisis, where banks really extended, went well beyond what their previous risk tolerance had been in order to lend both in the residential and in the commercial sector. I think that's something like what they're thinking of, as opposed to, but I'm not sure, because there's no question that not every crisis is like the last one.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, the implication, Matt, of your question is that there are certain black swan type activities that can't be predicted, but that occur with regularity, and that those present an equal challenge as the ones we've seen before and the ones we can plan for. But it really gets to that. I'm referring to the book, The Black Swan, which a lot of people after the crisis started to read, and took quite seriously, and I think it still factors into the analysis and should.
I might say it more that there are macroeconomic risks out there that they're not thinking of in their banker thought bubble, but I mean, neither here nor there, I guess. I had one other question, probably for Stephen, talking about cybersecurity issues with banks. And I had just written recently about how FINRA, and I know the SEC as well, they put out their list of exam priorities for 2016, and they're talking about security issues. You know, how well the regulators know what they are going to do to examine these issues, so that banks and financial firms can prepare for them. I suppose it's kind of like the last question I asked. Do they really know what they want to do with this risk here?
Well, it's constantly evolving. I mean, so in the security area, I think they are they're taking a little bit different approach, and they're trying to regulate in a way that is more situational, I guess is the way to put it. They're trying to avoid putting regulations kind of in stone, and they are preferring more of a one-off audit type approach to these kind of security issues, because as soon as they regulate something, it's out of date. I mean, you know, they say you have to double encrypt, and that means nothing if someone has the password, right? They do know that regulation is ineffective. What they are trying to figure out is how to regulate without regulation, I guess is a better way to put it. So, I mean, and that's kind of the move in all things cybersecurity. It's really, you know, share information, share best practices, and a more of an audit-related, anecdotal-type analysis of each individual firm than it is you must be secure, right? Or you must adhere to these particular standards, because every time they've done that, or most of the times, most of the financial institutions and the brokers and the like have met the standards. Easy to meet, and they still get hacked, right? Because, you know, as soon as the standards are out there, the criminals find a way to get around it. And so in the security space, the thought is more an active type of regulation than kind of a more passive rule. It's more to have a goal of security and figuring out how each individual institution is making that happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, those are all the questions I had, and I do have something else coming up for myself at 11, but thank you for this very informative hour. I really appreciate your time, and I wish I could stick around for more of it.
Well, we appreciate you joining
us. Thanks for joining.
Jackson, anything you want to close with? I think we're...
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming right up on the hour. I just wanted to thank everyone that could join on the phone today. you know, it was a really informative discussion, and I know, you know, both Jim and Steven would love to connect with anyone offline or, you know, through another phone call on any other things that you might be reporting on in the space or other things they might be seeing. But please.
That's a great point, Jackson. I absolutely. Please call us.
Yeah.
Jackson has our numbers. Call us anytime that you want to talk, and we're happy to do it.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Jim and Steven, for your time as well. And we'll be sending around a link to the audio recording of this just in case you want to go back to any of the particular panel sessions. But thank you all, and have a great rest of your week.
You too. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.